Well, hello again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can always find us on the web at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com and listen to any of our interviews by clicking on the Archive Interviews section. Patricia K. McCarthy was born on March the 3rd, 1963, in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. As she says, as an army brat. Her father was half Newfoundland Irish and German on her mother's side. She jokingly reminds us that I was born with the potent heritage of a meticulous drunk, the perfect misguided balance for a writer. She also was born with the most eclectic and acute ear for writing some of the best erotic literature I've heard in a long time. She feels that the art chooses the artist and not the other way around. Now, in 1998, she began penning erotic poems, approximately 600, and 300 were finally selected for published collections. After publishing a story for Man's Story 2 magazine, that ultimately led to her first vampire erotica novel, which has now become part of her Crimson Trilogy. The Crimson Man, The Crimson Boy, and the recently just released Crimson Woman. Now a resident of Ottawa, Canada, we are thrilled to have with us again Patricia K. McCarthy. Patricia, how are you doing?
Thanks, Jake. Thanks for having me back.
Well, Patricia, it's great to have you back again at Authors Audio. It's been about a year now since you've been on. And at that time, we talked about the second book of your trilogy called The Crimson Boy. And you've had a whole year to be naughty and nice and do your underground research that is so important in this genre that you write in called vampire erotica. And I highly recommend to my listeners that if you're feeling naughty and nice, that you grab yourself a little bottle of wine and get together on the couch or wherever you like and pick up a copy of Patricia's new book, The Crimson Woman, and just go crazy. You're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Heart palpitation territory, I call it, for some people.
Well, Patricia, for all our new listeners, perhaps you could give us a very short bio of yourself and how you got into this very interesting genre of vampire erotica.
It started off with short stories. Unfortunately, my mother never held on to the copies, but she said there was a spare typewriter. We would go visit friends, and it was down in the basement. And she said I would just go down there on my own and start chomping out a story, and I would bring it up to them, and they all thought it was hysterical. So I think there was something there, a desire to express myself from a young age. And I didn't actively pursue it, not in high school. It's when I started working up on Parliament Hill, when I was required to craft correspondence and proofread speeches, that I started up short stories again. And that went on for several years. Then I began to co-author a sort of a tongue-in-cheek book, which never fully got off the ground. And I started with erotic poetry, and that went on for quite a few years. And erotic poetry led me to a magazine in the U.S. called Man's Story 2. They bought some of my poems, and it was their suggestion or their urging, why don't you try writing us a short vampire story? And I thought it was a lot of fun, and I submitted three to them, and they purchased them. And it seemed to be a natural migration from erotic poetry to vampire stories and just the combining of the two. Before I know it, I found myself writing the first novel, The Crimson Man. I worked on that for a couple of years.
Well, I think for all the writers out there, it's important to realize that when Patricia said that she wrote a few poems, that she didn't write 20 or 30 poems. She wrote 600 poems, of which about half of those were published. And you can see some of those on her website. Is that right, Patricia?
Yes, I think that would best be described as obsessive. Yeah. I don't know why. You know, when you look back on your life and you dissect it, you can't really pinpoint, well, this is why I did this particular thing. For some reason, it just resonates with you. It would be the same as somebody asking you, well, 5 years ago, Jake, did you have an idea that you would be hosting your own radio program, interviewing authors and such? Not necessarily, you may not have had the idea, but now you're doing it. And I think it must resonate with you the way it does when it comes to writing. The art chooses the artist, which is an old theme that I believe in. But yeah, the poetry was just completely obsessive. I couldn't stop writing it. And then when I switched to short stories, ironically, the erotic poetry stopped pouring out of me. It literally dried up. So I thought, okay, you know what? I rang it out for all it was worth. And so it's time to move on to something else that was more challenging, which was the first novel.
So after the poetry, you seem to have found your voice for the novel, and the first one was The Crimson Man.
Correct.
And you got your main characters together in what I guess I could call a very liberated journey
yeah.
through the story. And your main protagonist, I believe, was Sir William Simon Hennessy. Is that correct?
Well, he shows up in number two. Yeah, the first one has the introduction of the married couple, Samuel Crimson and Magdalene, who becomes his wife. And the book itself, it leans very heavy on the erotica and less on the vampire mythology. But I purposely did it that way because I wanted to symbolize the intensity that all new relationships seem to carry, where so much of the focus can be on sex, which is often the case with new relationships. And it just explains how the characters met, how they developed their relationship, and why the male protagonist, Samuel, has to reveal his sort of hybrid identity to his wife. There's an event that acts as a catalyst in the story. And then we jump to the second one, The Crimson Boy, which explains the dilemma of Samuel having to meet his father, the one and only vampire on Earth, the true vampire, Sir William Simon Hennessy. And he learns about, you know, why his father did what he did. And that's how it started.
Well, now I have read two of your books, The Crimson Boy and The Crimson Woman, and I have read a synopsis of your first book, The Crimson Man. And I understand the first book is quite well spiced with the sexual overtones, shall we say. And so it's really ending up to be quite a trilogy.
I always forewarn people, crack open a bottle of wine, keep your partner close by or your favorite sex toys. And one woman recently, a store where I shop in the market here in Ottawa, she came up to me and she said, I have to buy all three and I want them signed each individually with a special inscription. So she started telling me what happened. She began to read the first one on riding the bus and she went, my God, just the way I was reacting to the story. She said, I couldn't believe what you were writing. And I thought, well, isn't that the whole purpose of erotica? To raise up your blood pressure, get your blood going?
Well, and I think I should remind my listeners, too, that these are not your average little dime store romantic novel with that romantic little illustration on the cover. These are adult books. They're very rapacious and very descriptive. And if that's your kind of thing, of course, if you do like sex or reading about it at least, I think these are the kind of books that you might be interested in. And, you know, I guess now we've got about almost 6.7 billion people on the planet. So I look at it this way, Patricia, if even a million people bought these books, these trilogies, you would be extremely happy.
I would probably get drunk for a week and run naked in the streets.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought that's what you normally did.
No, it would be wonderful. Thank God. Jake, we do not live in a vanilla world where everyone writes the same novel, where everyone has the same scope and the same needs and desires to be fulfilled. Thank God we don't live in that kind of world. Because if it, as an example, and I say this to people, if it were the 14th or 15th century, I would be rotting away in the Tower of London for what I've written. But this is the modern age, and so there are different tastes, and erotica can still be viewed by some people as pornography, but I always draw a distinction. For me, pornography is about the exploitation of sex. There's no real thematic content to it. It's just about the sex. But, well, yeah, but erotica is about the exploration of desire, and so that gives it a far, you know, wider net that you can cast. And again, I always forewarn people duly on the back of every novel. I tell them, you know, some of it is graphic and explicit. But the third came out far more romantic than I had anticipated.
I think it's important to say, too, that writing, being a very organic craft and art, that sometimes you just don't know where the story is going to lead you, where the characters are going to lead you, and sometimes you just take that 90-degree turn, which makes the story so much more interesting, and that's, of course, part of the great joy of writing, isn't it?
It's so true, yeah, the characters, they take on a life of their own. I know it sounds so cliche, oh, the organic process, and, you know, you can perfectly craft out a plot by chapter, by scene, and that is so painstaking. And I've tried to do that, and I have a very rough outline of a plot. I even have a sense of how many words I want to target for. And then this happens every time I start to write where I'm in a chapter, and suddenly this conversation goes off on a different angle, and I go, oh, I like that even better than what I originally thought I should do. So you really do have to be open. Don't be possessive about your ideas, because the minute you are, you close yourself off to new opportunities in the story.
Yes, I think that's all good information for new writers. Another thing I wanted to ask you, I probably asked you before in another interview, but maybe you could tell our audience just what is your discipline? How do you format yourself to write? Do you write every day? Do you write in the morning, the evening? Do you have any special tricks that you can pass along to our would-be upcoming writers?
Yeah, you do. You have to, at the very least, look at your manuscript every day, even if it's just to review what you wrote the day prior. You have to at least stay in contact with it. And what happens also when you have worked on a trilogy or a series, you have to stay in touch with the previous novels as well, so that you continue that mood in your mind while you're writing. Because right now, the third officially came out in the end of May, June. It's in bookstores now, and I sell it on my website. But my mind and head is already in the fourth, because I've decided to make it into a sextuplet, a series of six novels. So I'm already halfway writing through the fourth, and periodically I have to go back and reread 1, 2, and 3 so that I keep that connection with it. But you really do, you've got to, it's like anything. It's not going to get done unless you work on it. And at the same time, you still have to give yourself breaks so that you clear your head. While I was pulling together The Crimson Woman through the editing process, I didn't work on the fourth because I needed a break from it. And then I came back with a fresh pair of eyes on the fourth, and I thought, I cannot write, I've lost it. So you have these crashing moments, and you push yourself and you start writing again, and then it starts to pour. As I say, writing, it seems to work one of two ways. Either it pushes or it pours. And when I say, or pull or pour, when I say pour, I mean it literally pours out of you. And when you have to pull, that's when you've got to really work hard at pulling it out of you. So if you're lucky, it'll pour most of the time, but don't expect it to go that way all the time.
Well, I guess we could say, really, like some days we just get lucky and, you know, we're there with the right words in the right place and everything's just falling into place so sweetly. But those days are usually prefaced with other days of hard labor and using the eraser more than the pencil, probably.
Some people have regular time periods when they feel the most fertile in their imagination. Right now, I'm in between my full-time jobs. The last company I worked for, they let us go at the end of April. And so I thought, oh, well, that's excellent. In between getting another job, I'll be able to spend even more time working on the novels. And I have found that my rhythm has changed a bit. And so I think you fall into different rhythms depending on how your life is structured. Again, you have to be malleable. You can't have these rigid ideas that, well, I can only write as a night owl from midnight till 2 a.m. It will change because you're a human being, and so you're going to change as well.
Now, I know that many people will know your first two books, but I think your book launching for the third and final book of the trilogy, The Crimson Woman, is going to be in Ottawa in September, correct?
The book launch party for The Crimson Woman is on September the 13th, a Saturday. It's being held at Venus Envy Sex and Bookstore on Lisgar Street at 7:30 till 9:30. Yeah, you're more than welcome.
Well, I couldn't think of a better name myself. It's the Venus Envy Bookstore, and I want all my listeners to flock down there because it also will be a book signing, and you'll get to meet Patricia K. McCarthy, too. Fantastic.
The other aspect of your writing is the huckstering, that you've got to actually sell your work. Yeah, you have to pimp it, as I say. That's the hardest part, is having to pimp your work. And by that, you do it through linking up with other individuals, by getting exposure and interviews and having your book reviewed. And I have a new publicist who's come online, who will be coming online in August. And him and I were sitting down, and he said, you thought the creative process was hard. He said, wait till you start the full marketing campaign. And I thought, yeah, he's right.
Well, I think if we might, I'd like you to maybe get into a little bit of the story of this new book, The Crimson Woman, coming out in September. Without giving the plot away, of course, and maybe we can just talk about that, since give the readers a little taste of what they're about to digest.
It's more romantic in nature, and it is the conclusion to the cliffhanger in The Crimson Boy, the second one. So you have the first. I try to write all three novels in such a way that you could read them on their own as a separate story. And number one is like that. And then number two, the same characters come back, but I leave it as a cliffhanger. And so number three, I resolve that dilemma. And there is what I call intellectual foreplay in the novel, because two principal characters, there's a bit of a tug of war between them, not wanting to get too much detail into it. And there's far more irreverence as well. That you think, one of my editors, he was just saying, that would have been the last way I would have thought of trying to battle a vampire, the solution that you came up with. And he thought it was the most unconventional, and that's exactly what I wanted to do. I didn't want to make a classic, impale the vampire in the end, and he turns to dust, and, you know, or you wake him up sleeping in his coffin. My one and only vampire on Earth is not like that at all.
Now, there are many different authors out there in this style, in this genre. How would you say your style differs from theirs?
Good question. One of my editors referred to me as the anti-Stephanie Myers because her vampire stories, she's a competitor, obviously. They are very romantic in nature. There's no sex in them. There is hardly any kissing whatsoever. And her vampires, you know, of course, they still bite necks and so forth. Whereas mine, it has its three graduating levels of explicit and graphic sex. And then number two, there's some sex, but it becomes more of a Quentin Tarantino-esque type thriller. And then number three, where it is all intellectual foreplay, as I call it, and romance, but it deals with the issue of what to do with this one and only vampire on Earth. The underlying current in all of it is that the son, who's the hybrid vampire, he thinks of himself as being a humanitarian, and so he doesn't actually want to kill people for that need for blood, that he uses a different technique. And when he finally meets his father, Sir William Simon Hennessy, his own father tries the technique himself before he passes judgment. And he realizes that his son taught him he could have lived his long life without having to kill so many people. So I would say the third has a lot of elements of philosophical discussion and morality. And I think that's inevitable when you're dealing with the subject of vampire mythology, because, as you say, we've got 6 billion people in the world, and so you have one vampire going around killing hundreds of thousands. Does it matter in the long run? Well, of course it does. It's still a question of your attitude towards life, and do you hold it dear?
Do you see the vampire role model, the psychological role model, as a metaphor for something sort of deep in the psychological process? Because, of course, it's always related to the idea of the taking of blood and also sexual kind of a relationship also. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. To me, the vampire represents longevity and power and an untouchable. Something that, because that's what fiction is all about for me. Fiction is about giving the imagination full rein to have a mind of its own. And vampire mythology, we know historically it's got roots with the first novel that came out in the late 1900s, Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Which some people say was based upon Vlad III the Impaler, a Romanian ruler who died when, 1476, and he was known for his cruelty and how he punished people. So they think that that inspired Bram Stoker's story. So I think when it comes to vampire mythology, there has always been this element of, it's untouchable, you shouldn't be reading it, you shouldn't be thinking it, you should be above this kind of lascivious mind. But that's its whole allure. That's, you know, where the potential lies, that it lets you go out of your world into a completely different fictional world. And as a couple of readers have told me, I loved reading your books just for the fun of it, because sometimes they shocked me. And they tell you, you know what, there are very few things that can shock me anymore in this day and age. Maybe that's true. I don't know.
Well, speaking of shocking, I'm wondering, Patricia, if you would give our listeners and our future readers just a tantalizing taste of what is between the covers of your new book, The Crimson Woman, if you would be kind enough to do that.
Okay, I'd be delighted to. Okay, this is Chapter 22, The Crimson Woman. The unusual choice of time ideally suits an unencumbered stroll in the enclave as the lazy streets roll up past the darker stage of twilight, and the windows and doors shut and lock, and the few who walk alone, are unaware of what fate awaits. Nighttime is the cloak, shrouding the frightening dream that twists the day of sun and cloud into a disguised form of incubus, the ancient demon who extracts purity from females. Nighttime is the drinker of blood pouring out from between sumptuous plump thighs and suffocating the cries of objection. Nighttime absorbs and swallows the life-giving sustenance, for at night, when all should be safe at home, anything and everything is possible. The least is unimaginable, and few know enough to remain indoors. Yet, he is also entirely at ease during daytime. And while his preference is for night roaming, In light, he is calm and reserved, for the unraveling of his eternal being moves in any sphere of time and space. He delights in the irony, knowing she sleeps during the day in the rented home he selected so very close to her own. She sleeps next door. Sir William's steps are characteristically silent and smooth. He moves in Sandy Hill, walking south on Chapel Street, then left on Stewart before arriving at Augusta and Wilbroad. He begins his surveillance of blood potential. It has been days since feeding, and his hunger is intense, but he utilizes a developed defense mechanism for quelling his desire without expending unnecessary effort. His mind produces detailed imagery of plates of solid foods to satisfy the rabid lust of 100 men. He wants to feed before he speaks at length with Magdalene, before he leads her to enlightenment by revealing her ultimate purpose. He estimates there is less than 2 years remaining in the remarkable period of time that is his life. Once the new offspring is thriving, born from the love of his hybrid son and human wife. High heels clip the pavement with a distinct click. Sir William moves his chin over his shoulder and spots her. Her scent carries ahead of her body, some 15 feet in front as she walks, rushing as he watches her pass. She is presently in the cycle of the moon, and his nostrils naturally flare. He follows her slowly because she looks back at him often until believing he poses no threat. His gray hair and slow as sloth movements throw off many conquests, unsuspecting of his ability to rapidly change speed. He observes her as she rounds the corner and he follows. She bravely ducks into an overshadowed path leading to Laurier Street, a bowered shortcut through the one-way streets known to the locals as Lover's Lane. But before she reaches the opposite exit, he is upon her. The fear in her eyes is paralyzing because she does not hear or see him until she feels the electric touch of his hand on her shoulder. A woman who bleeds, begins Sir William, is a woman of whom I am in need. Help! She screams frantically, bolting ahead, lunging into the street out of the sanctuary of the fenced path. Sir William grabs her arm, pulling her back in, lifting her over top the fence where it meets in middle with a black iron gate, resting her on top of a patch of overgrown grass. She opens her mouth to yell, but his palm muffles her words. He smiles and in so doing bares fangs, slightly touching lower lip, leaving a distinct indentation. His fangs are prominent and razor sharp, a color of supreme white. She faints. Women are susceptible to sensitivity because God has blessed you with deep emotion and the ability to feel the pain of those around, unlike men I have found who are intractable so often in their approach to coping with other persons, remarks Sir William aloud as he stretches out her limbs, arms and legs into a relaxed sleeping pattern. He brushes his hand across her pelvis, rubbing her stomach softly, tracing the outline of her body and feeling the plumpness of her flesh, marveling at the complexity of human females. He clearly knows what he wants, with fangs ready to puncture the unbroken skin on her neck. He purposely forbids himself. She wears a tight-fitting skirt. Sir William reaches underneath, reaching higher until finding the fissure of flesh between her legs. He squirms his fingers inside her panties, sliding into her opening. He digs deeply and pulls out stained fingers and brings them to his nose and smells. The scent of her blood gathers inside his nose like fallen lotus leaves floating upon glass waters. He inhales deeply and returns his fingers to her lips and pulls out more blood. Her eyes open. I'll leave it right there for now, Jake.
Well, thank you so much, Patricia, for being on the program. And remember, folks, we've been talking with Patricia K. McCarthy of Ottawa, Canada, one of Canada's premier authors in the genre of vampire erotica, and you can find her website at patriciakmccarthy.com. You can also find her book on our webpage at authorsaudio.com. And it's been another wonderful program, and to everyone out there, keep dreaming and happy reading. This is Jake D. Steele. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.